Good day, everyone. Welcome back to Dreams Warp, the podcast designed to awaken you to a new reality. For today's episode, you know what day it is. It's Sunday, and that means it's time for our Zen stream. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode. Hey all, before we get into this, I just need to allow a quick word from a sponsor. Thanks for your patience. All right, let's go ahead and get into this. My name is George, and if this is your first time here, first I want to say thank you for checking out the podcast. The purpose of this podcast is to explore the mind and the depths of consciousness that creates it. Ultimately, the podcast is here to help you gain a sense of mastery over your reality in your life by mastering your mind. So if that's something that interests you, you have definitely come to the right place. By the way, if you find the content on this podcast helpful, I hope you'll consider sharing it with others. Now, we have a few series on the podcast. We have our Tuesday Taoism, we have our Zen stream on Sundays, and then I do try to throw in an extra episode whenever possible here and there related to, related topic, mental health, manifesting, relationships, basically anything and everything, meditation, mindfulness, all that stuff, devoted to helping you achieve your goals, reach your dreams, just live an overall happier day-to-day life. Now, today is Sunday, and we're doing our Zen stream, and I found a very interesting reading I have been sharing with you all. For those of you who've been listening for a little while, I've been sharing from this book written by a pretty well-known Vietnamese Zen monk. His name is Thich Nhat Hanh. He's quite up there in age now. My understanding is he had a stroke a few years ago, I think. He's frail, kind of limited. I don't know if he's able to speak anymore, but I do know that he's still alive. And he has a lot of people caring for him. So, it's an interesting situation for him. But he has shared just some amazing things during his life. And one of the things he created was this book that I've been reading from called Your True Home. And it's a collection of very short meditations. I've been reading from it and for our Zen stream now for quite a while. I'd say a few months, maybe a year already. Probably a year. Anyway, I found a very interesting passage that I wanted to share with you. And it actually deals with dealing basically trauma and hurt from the past. And this really has been a huge issue in my life, not necessarily from my own personal trauma or hurt from my past. I mean, obviously, there is, we all have hurt from our past. Some of us have experienced, real traumatic events in our past. And others of us, maybe not something that would rise to the label of what we would call trauma, but still, we all have suffering and things that we have been through that definitely affect us today. And the reason I say that that's been a big thing in my life is that 9 years of my 16 years or so practicing psychotherapy and working in mental health were completely devoted to PTSD trauma. And, learning basically how to recover from traumatic events and how to heal, so to speak, from traumatic events. And how you define healing, that varies from person to person. That's not really what I'm going to be getting into in this particular episode. But I want to read to you this passage that he wrote, which he called Images of the Past. And it's going to basically share a little bit about how even some of the stuff that we talk about here and during our Zen stream can apply to things like dealing with trauma and hurt from the past. And just a little disclaimer here, actually two disclaimers I want to put out there. Number one is if you are suffering with a condition such as PTSD, depression, suicidality, anything like that, I highly recommend that you seek professional help near you. The intent of this podcast and this episode is not to diagnose, treat, prevent, cure any kind of mental health issue. I would consider this stuff adjunct, stuff that you could add to what your already existing treatment that can hopefully, you know, add a little benefit and help support you further in the work that you're already doing with a professional near you. That's one disclaimer. So let me say that. Second disclaimer is a little bit more not as serious, is that I have a tendency when we get into topics like this to start getting a little bit clinical on you. So I kind of apologize in advance if that starts happening. It's habit. It's stuff that I talk about and did talk about for years and years and years and years and years. So it's very habitual for me to get into that kind of rhythm. But I'll do my best to continue to connect it to stuff that we normally talk about here on ZenStream and really living mindfully. I really love, by the way, Eckhart Tolle's description of Zen, which is walking on the razor's edge of now, okay? It's of all the different descriptions or practices I've heard of within the vast umbrella that today they call mindfulness, Zen is definitely like the extreme, the most extreme kind of mindfulness, where the awareness of the present moment is so emphasized. And it's, it goes very, very, very deep into that end of the pool, so to speak. So let me go ahead and read this. I know that was a long intro, but let me go ahead and read this, and then we'll talk a little bit about what I'm getting out of this and how we can use this in our practice of looking at issues from the past, trauma, hurt, and healing from that and living with it in a positive way today as best we can. So this passage again is called Images of the Past, and it goes like this. If we have been abused as a child, almost anything we see or hear can bring us back to that image of being abused. Being so constantly in touch with these images of the past can give rise to feelings of fear, anger, and despair. We call this, quote, inappropriate attention, end quote. And in Sanskrit, he writes in parentheses, anyoniso manaskara. I guess that's the term for it in Sanskrit. And then he goes on to say, because we call this inappropriate attention because it takes away from the present moment and into a place of old suffering. It is very important that whenever our attention is brought to that place, to that kind of image, we have ways of dealing with the sorrow, fear, and suffering that arise. When suffering arises, our practice is to breathe in and out and say, quote, breathing in, I know that suffering is in me, end quote. Recognizing and embracing the mental formation is our practice. With the energy of mindfulness, we recognize that our old suffering is only an image, it's not reality. And we can see that life, with all its wonders, is here, that living happily in the present moment is possible. And then we can change the whole situation. That's the end of the passage. It's a little long compared to others that I've read. This one's a little bit on the longer side. So in a nutshell, what he's pointing towards, okay, is something that we talk a lot about when we talk about dealing or healing from past trauma, past hurt. And he mentions this idea of, first thing that really connects to me is where he says, almost anything we see or hear can bring us back to that image. So that's something that we talk a whole lot about when we're dealing with something like PTSD, is that any sensory information that appears in the present moment that has any kind of similarity to some bit of sensory information that was present during the moment of the trauma, then the brain and the body respond as if the trauma were happening again. And of course, these are often referred to as triggers, right? So an example that I've used countless times is if someone is involved in a horrible car accident. And let's say that, the car flips and they're trapped in the vehicle and maybe there's a fuel leak and the person's smelling this gas, smelling it, right? You can say that the smell of gasoline now becomes a trigger. So in the future, weeks, months, years, you know, in the future, if the person, not everyone necessarily develops something like PTSD from an event like that, but some do. And those that do, one of the symptoms that can present is that whenever the person gets even a small, tiny whiff of gas, gasoline, their body responds, their mind responds as if it was pinned back in that vehicle, right? So you get all this kind of physiological things happen. Your heart rate can go up, your pulse can, same thing, your heart rate, pulse can go up, blood pressure can go up, you start sweating, your muscles get tense, your stomach may tighten, you know, you may start to get jittery, shaky, and you may have these images begin to appear in your mind of being trapped back in that vehicle, depending on how severe, you know, the trigger is. And, you know, there's a lot of other factors that can go into that. It's too much to get into right now. But you get the general idea. And that's what he talks about in that first line. Almost anything, he says, quote, almost anything we see or hear can bring us back to that image of being abused. Now, interesting, the next line says, being so constantly in touch with these images of the past can give rise to feelings of fear, anger, or despair. Now, if I want to get really, really, really split hairs here and get real clinical on you, anger is technically not 100% correct. Anger can arise, absolutely can arise. But the anger and both anger and guilt are interesting in the context of strictly speaking PTSD, because generally during the moment of a traumatic experience, for example, being trapped in the vehicle, which is the one that I was using, at that moment, you're not really feeling anger or guilt, right? You're probably scared out of your mind, feeling very vulnerable, panicky, you know, feeling helpless. Worry, right? Anger and guilt, if they appear, doesn't mean they always will, usually comes after the moment of trauma is over and the person reflects back on what happens, right? As a memory, and then they add beliefs to it. Oh, that other person hit me. I can't believe they did that. I'm going to sue and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. That's anger, right? Is anger is trying to now, deal with those uncomfortable feelings from what happened by trying to reassert control, right? And that's where anger arises. Guilt is similar, but it's different. Guilt is, oh, I should have been paying more attention. I shouldn't have been on my phone. I should have been this. I should have been that. I should have, you know, turned left. I shouldn't have taken the expressway. I shouldn't have been speeding, right? But all those things, you don't have those thoughts in the middle of the traumatic event. The traumatic event is usually, you know, more, oh my God, I might die, right? Typically, that's really what is being processed in the actual moment of the trauma itself, when you're pinned in the vehicle. Anger and guilt, 99.9% of the time, arises after, when the event has become a memory, and now we are dealing with or learning how to cope with the memory, okay, and the feelings that come with the memory. So you can say, in a sense, okay, in a sense, that anger and guilt are secondary, right? They come after the trauma, and they usually layer on top of those more uncomfortable feelings, vulnerability, helplessness, fear, that kind of stuff. So those feelings, or a combination of those feelings, can arise, as he says here, when you are so constantly, quote, so constantly in touch with these images. So he goes then on to say, okay, that, quote, it is very important that whenever our attention is brought to that place, to that kind of image, we have a way of dealing with the sorrow, fear, and suffering that arise. That is 100% true. But and we're going to talk about how actually we do that, right? It's nice to write that, nice to say that, but how exactly does that happen? So then he goes on to say, when that suffering arises, our practice is to breathe in and to breathe out and say, breathing in, I know that suffering is in me, okay? And that's pretty good, but I want to expand on that a little bit by adding some of the more, you know, clinical stuff, okay? And we're going to do that in just a second. So, but before we do that, he does add another line here that says, recognizing and embracing the mental formation, which is in this case, the memory, is our practice. Okay, with the energy of mindfulness, he goes on to say, we recognize that the old suffering is only an image. It's not reality. We're going to talk about that too. Okay, so we got quite a few lines here that he writes that I want to really, really explain and get a little bit more deep into. Hopefully, again, it'll help you whether you're dealing with trauma or just hurt from the past. Let me just pause here for a quick second, allow a word from a sponsor, and I will be right back. All right, you all, I'm back. Thank you for your patience. Just want to take a quick moment here and remind you that if you ever have a question, you want to make a suggestion, express a concern, give me any ideas for future podcast episodes, you can email me at elucidatethereal@gmail.com. You could also leave a comment on any one of my YouTube videos. Find my YouTube channel, Dreams Warp, same name. Find any video, leave a comment. I get notified right away, and I can respond to you there. Also, recently, I started up a Twitter account, and I'm posting there, pretty often, once a day, every couple days. I either retweet something I read that I really like, or I put some of my own stuff up there, content, just to give you little reminders throughout the day to focus on your practice. So make sure you follow me on Twitter to get that good stuff. And finally, if you're enjoying this content and you are on Apple Podcasts, it would really help me out if you could take a moment and just leave a nice rating and review. All right, so where did we leave off? We were talking about these images from the past that can appear, hurt, trauma, and how do we deal with them, basically? That's the question, when they arise, right? When you have these triggers, as I described in the previous segment, and we have these painful feelings arise, how do we deal with them, and how do we get them to stop being as intense? And he gives us some suggestions in this little passage. He talked about when it arises, the practice is to breathe in, breathe out, say to yourself, breathing in, I know that suffering is in me, recognizing, embracing the mental formation, using mindfulness, we can recognize that the old suffering is only an image, not reality. All that stuff is nice, but let's dig a little deeper into these sentences and add a little bit to this that I think can help. So one of the things that I found very interesting and amazing as I started learning more and more about working with individuals who were dealing with hurt from the past, trauma from the past, is that people generally, again, you know, I have speaking generalizations here because individually we're all different and we all deal with these things in our own ways. But generally people fall into two broad categories. You have people who either they deal with the past hurt by trying not to look at it at all, right? They try to ignore it. You could call that, I guess, a type of avoidance or suppression, right? They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to think about it. They don't want to, you know, see anything reminds them of it. They don't want to, I mean, they totally try to ignore that it's there, okay? That's one type. The other type is kind of the opposite, is that they almost can't focus on anything but that. So it basically is all the times what they talk about, they're emotional all the time. We call it basically in clinical terms, we called it over-engagement. So you have avoidance, right? The under-engager and the over-engager. Neither one are ideal. Now, let me be clear. It's not to say that both of them are wrong, both groups are wrong. Really, the way we determine whether or not it's good, the way that they're coping, is how much is the way that they're coping affecting their ability to be happy now, to function now. So in other words, if there's a person who has a trauma from the past or hurt from the past, they don't like talking about it, they don't like, right, I'm talking about the under-engager, right, as an example, but they have no real problems in their life. They're married. They have a job. They're happy. They have hobbies. They have fun. They enjoy their life. They have a good spiritual practice. They eat well. They sleep well. They exercise. Then the way they're coping is fine. The fact that they're under-engaging is not an issue, right? Because it's not really affecting them in any major way. Same thing with the over-engager, although that would probably be a little more rare, right? Considering how I just described the over-engager is somebody who is constantly, you know, just can't seem to escape this image and the feelings associated to this image from the past. So, you know, obviously it would be more difficult for a person like that to have, you know, happy life for, you know, obvious reasons. But either category, either one can still have things present in their current life, in their current present moment, their current reality that is not to their liking. And it is that lack of joy, that lack of happiness, that pain, that suffering is connected to that hurt or that trauma from the past. And clearly, the way that they are coping with that image appearing and the accompanying feelings is not working. That's really what we're looking for, is what's working versus what's not working versus what's right or what's wrong. So when we have these two broad categories, what starts to become very clear is that there has to be a middle way, right? And I laugh because in Buddhism, you know, the Buddha taught about the middle way, right? 2,500 years ago. So it's almost a little bit of a pun there. That by describing these two extremes, almost picture this on a scale, right? Picture a line, and on one end, you have one group that's the under-engager. On the other end of the line, you have the over-engagers. That leaves a big gap in the middle. And that is, I would say, like the area of real healing, right? So we now can use something like, as a metaphor, we can use something like a broken bone or a burn on the body. Or I used to work with a doctor who described dealing with trauma as like, if somebody has a cyst, right, is popping it. Okay, I know that's a little graphic, but the idea is that when we're setting a bone, we're cleaning a burn, or we're popping a cyst, it's painful, but we're doing it in an environment, okay, where that pain from cleaning it, from setting the bone, from popping the cyst can be managed, can be supported, okay? You can assist the person through it. Because what you can say is that the over-engager is, it's almost as if they're walking around with the broken bone, and it's like they're constantly trying to use the arm even though it's broken. Let's say that the broken bone is in the arm. They're constantly trying to use the arm and set the bone themselves, but they don't have the help. They don't have the resources. They don't have the ability, or even you can say, especially the internal resources, meaning the stability, the centeredness. And this is where the practice comes in so much, is that when you have a strong mindfulness practice, when you have a strong spiritual practice, or you have a very strong faith, or you have a group of people that can support you, that can help you, you are creating an environment in which the person can feel stable enough to begin really setting this bone. But before that happens, the over-engager, you could say, is continuing to try to use that arm, even though there's so much pain and there's no support around them to help them do that. The under-engager tries to pretend, doesn't try to use the arm, just hides it, tries to pretend that the arm's not broken. I'll just get by with my other arm. I'm not going to even look at that. I'm not even going to pay attention to that. I'm not even going to talk about that, right? But it's still hurting. It's still there. So we have to start coming into the middle where we are setting the bone. We are cleaning the burn, so to speak, which is also very uncomfortable, very painful. If you've ever had a bad burn, I'm sure you know what that's like. Or you're popping the cyst, right? It's all very painful. But what happens is that as the supports are put in place around the person, right? And again, those supports can come even from internal practice. So the practice of self-compassion, like he says here in the reading, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, I know that suffering is in me. Recognizing and embracing the mental formation is our practice. But how can you embrace it if you don't have the resources within to do that? And this is really where it's most important, going back to my original disclaimer, of having maybe a professional, maybe a spiritual advisor, a counselor, or maybe a loved one, somebody who can, if you don't have those internal resources that can help support you with that resource so that you could then deal with those feelings in a healthy way, in a healthy environment. So the idea is here is that as I worked with individuals, processing, I guess is the word we would use, right? But processing is basically mindfully looking at the memory of the event. What starts to happen, done in the appropriate setting with the appropriate supports, is that the memory never erases, right? The memory never goes away, but the memory stops triggering that physiological response. In other words, the memory stops tricking the body into thinking that the trauma is happening now, because in ultimate reality, the traumatic memory is not the trauma, right? A memory cannot be a trauma. Trauma, by definition, is a situation or an event where there's a threat of death, dismemberment, severe injury. A memory cannot do that to you, right? Now, a memory can make you feel extremely uncomfortable. Maybe somebody could make the argument that if somebody has a heart condition or, they get very, they have a very strong memory, maybe they get overwhelmed, they might have a heart attack. Okay, I get that. But generally speaking, okay, a memory cannot kill you, okay? A memory is a series of chemical reactions in the brain, and it's an image along with associated feelings. So part of the work in trauma is helping the person convert that memory, okay, from a trauma happening now to a memory of a trauma that happened in the past. And constantly reinforcing this idea that the memory itself, just the image and the associated feelings, should not be triggering the fight-flight response, should not be triggering that physiological response of, oh my God, I'm going to die. That is the key thing. And you do that, like he says here in this little chapter, being able to mindfully, compassionately looking at the memory, recognizing the feelings, and as he says here, and I love this choice of words, he says, embracing the mental formation. It's almost as if you are providing that memory with the right kind of attention. It's a loving, compassionate attention. That's how we heal anything, right? And think about when you're a little kid and you fall, you skin your knee or you skin your elbow. Where do? You run to your mom, you run to your dad. Oh, my knee, right? And what does mom or dad do? They look at it, they blow on it, they clean it, they put a bandage on it, right? They compassionately, lovingly give attention to that wound. And in very much the same way, when we look at hurt from the past or trauma from the past, it's similar, but we almost become our own parents. And part of that is having the responsibility to sometimes look for another person who can help, another person who can create that kind of supportive environment where you can then mindfully give full attention to that image and that hurt from the past. And through that process, as uncomfortable as it can be, we can start to heal from that. And it stops becoming an image that constantly presents itself in a way that is, it's not welcome, it's hurtful, it's overwhelming, and it's triggering that.